What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson.
I studied exercise physiology and competed in many various sports ranging from wrestling to ultra running. I use that knowledge to combine today's science with ancient wisdom to live an optimal lifestyle and to spread that information onto the masses.
I'm a lifelong weightlifter and I'm obsessed with health and wellness. My degree in biology, with an emphasis in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior, allows me to take a deep dive into the most current literature and bring that information to you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to show your support, please rate and review on your favorite podcast provider, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or SoundCloud. Also, sign up on our website, tntwellnessandnutrition.com, for all of our up-to-date content.
Let's get this started. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This is episode 81. We're finally starting our Keto for Cancer series. This is most likely going to be a three-part series just because there is so much information to go over. We want to break it down into more digestible parts. So today we'll get through part one, mainly talking about the history of cancer and why we believe a low-carb diet is great for the prevention of cancer or even the management of cancer if you do have it. But first, a quick check-in. So, Tom, how's your week been?
So I finally ran my first ultra marathon of the year. It was this last Saturday on leap day. It was a 50K. I crushed my previous best, a solid hour and a half time.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and honestly, it would have been a lot better. So around mile 16 to 17, somewhere around there, I was at a little under 3 hours. And my goal for the whole thing was to get it in 6 hours, which would have been almost like 2.5 hours better than my previous best. So that's a kind of a unrealistic goal.
Huge goal.
Yeah, but I was like, I can do this. I can do this. So everything was going great at that point, especially because the first half of the course is a lot tougher than the second half. And so I did over half of it in under 3 hours. Everything was going good. But the only problem was, is there was like either 8 or 9 miles to the next aid station. And a couple guys behind me are like, oh, hey, you got to fuel up. You better fuel up. And in my head, I'm like, no, I don't. I don't need to.
Oh, so you're running like a pack?
There were so many people.
Oh, really?
And the further along you go, the more everybody gets separated.
Yeah.
But like the first half of the course, yeah. I mean, especially the first like 3 stops, oh, it was super packed.
Oh, okay.
Like I ended up having to walk like probably the first like half mile just because there was nowhere to run. Like there's just no room or anything. It kind of sucked. But
that's surprising to me. I thought not too many people would be doing this, but I guess I'm wrong.
So there was over 400 people that started it.
And
the trail was extremely narrow. It's pretty much, the majority of it is like a single trail. So it's like single file, 400 people, everybody started at the same time. Yeah, that shit sucked.
Yeah, okay.
Let me just get into this part first.
Sure.
So I get some trail mix. I'm just thinking something salty, still pretty fatty, but it's got some sugar in it too. This will be super easy to digest.
You had this on you?
No, they have it at the aid stations.
Oh, okay.
So they have stuff like that, Oreos, pickles, salted potatoes. They have
Oreos sound good to me.
Almost everything's vegan.
Okay,
because a lot of runners are.
Yeah, sure.
And then they'll have some sodas and some like electrolyte drinks, okay, stuff like that. So I just got like a Dixie cup and filled that up with trail mix. I'm like, oh, okay, this will be perfect. Something salty, something with a little bit of sugar, this should be perfect. So I finished that probably within like the first mile after.
And hold on, hard stop. Trail mix is not normally in your routine.
Never. I don't remember the last time I had trail mix, but just looking at everything there, like that one was speaking to me.
Got it.
Biggest mistake I ever made. So I finished that at probably like around mile one after this aid station.
Yeah.
So that's like 17, 18 miles into this course. The next aid station is 9 miles past this previous one. So about mile two, man, my stomach is just tearing up. I'm like, oh, I'm going to throw up. Nope. I'm just going to come out the other end. I'm just like, and at this point in the race, we're running along like people's backyards.
Okay.
Like the trail is like right behind somebody's backyard. So like I can see into people's houses. So there's nowhere I can just run off the course if I need to.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'll be a plate sight. So from my mile two to like mile 8 or 9, my stomach was just in knots. I was so glad to make it to that next aid station, but I was going so slow. I was just hurting. I was struggling that whole time.
Yeah.
Finally get to that next aid station. There's a porta potty there. Do my thing in there. After that, I felt great.
Okay.
And then continued on my way. But man, did that 8 or 9 miles suck.
Jeez.
So I think like if I didn't have that damn trail mix, like that would have cut off, I don't know, about 40 minutes, but it could have.
Yeah.
I mean, especially because after that, like that took a lot out of me. My back was like all tightening up. I was doing a lot of clinching and everything.
Even mental energy.
Yeah. But after I finished that, I didn't stop at another aid station. I was like, screw these aids.
Yeah.
This is straight poison for me right now.
Yeah.
So at the beginning, how everybody's all clumped up. So one of my biggest, I guess, weaknesses in this game has been on downhill running. Part of it is just inexperience. Part of it is just not having the right shoes. So now I have the right shoes and I have a lot of experience with downhill running. So when there was that first downhill and like finally the trail was like barely wide enough for me to squeeze past people, I probably passed a good 50, maybe 80 people like within a quarter mile stretch of like this downhill run.
Because you're running.
Because I'm running. Everybody else is slamming on the brakes. Like me and only one other person were just like on the left, just like weaving in and out of traffic, just like flying past everybody.
Yeah.
And it was funny, after we got through that, we're like, damn, that was a lot of fun.
Really?
I was like, yeah, I'm not trying to tire myself out. Like, I'm going to let gravity do the work wherever I can, you know?
Hold on, did you actually talk to the person you did that with? Oh, so that was an actual conversation.
Yeah, like we flew past like everybody. We were like, we finally saw like enough room to run and we're just like running.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like I was putting in effort. It was just like, this is how fast gravity wants me to go.
I'm going this fast.
This is how fast I'm going to go.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Everybody else is going hella slow, you know, hitting the brakes, and that kills your quads. This is the first time after a race, like, my quads didn't feel anything. Like, I was good to go with my quads. My hamstrings were a little tight. My lower back was a little tight. I think that has to do with my backpack.
Okay.
My backpack's way too big for this type of race. So, all the fluids that I brought with me was enough for the entire race. I did not need to stop at a single aid station.
Okay.
There are 6 aid stations. So, I don't need to carry that much fluid. When I have all these, there's like a aid station supposed to be like every 5 miles, except for that 1 9-mile like break.
Mm-hmm.
So if I get a smaller backpack, like I can carry a lot less. That'll put a lot less wear and tear on my back, my like lower, like my butt, my legs, that type of thing. So that's one thing I'm going to invest in, is getting a smaller backpack that's just big enough to make it maybe 10 miles instead of 30 miles.
Just minimal.
Yeah. It's great to have this backpack because when I do these longer runs without any aids.
Like, you need it.
Yeah. But when I have all this aid stations like every 5 miles, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly.
It's completely unnecessary. So I think like those two things, if I switched that up, I would have been able to hit that 6-hour goal. But whatever, I'm not really tripping. It's still 90 minutes better than my previous best. I have a 50-miler coming up April 4th. And that's almost the same identical course. It's just like on the opposite side of the lake that I just ran on and going the opposite way. So
yeah.
I'm pretty comfortable with it, looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's cool, man, because it just shows, I knew you could do it first off, but your experience is paying off, your training is paying off, and you learn so much even from this one race, that it's in 30 days, your next race, you're going to do better.
Yeah, oh yeah.
No granola, small backpack, and with any hills, you're going to smoke them.
Yeah, I cannot wait for it.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I did the whole thing without headphones. This is the first time I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping to get some, like, some good thought process going
on. Some zen moments.
Yeah, normally on my private runs, I can get that. I don't know what was going on with this one, but I didn't really have any good thoughts except for one. So there's this one part, I forget what part of the race it's in. It's at least after mile 10, between mile, like, 10 and 20. So it's a pretty steep uphill. Like, most of the time, a lot of runners do this. They walk the steep uphills. They'll kind of go on, like, a nice slow run during the flats, and for me, like, I'm basically sprinting on the downhills.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the way I break it down. So I'm like walking uphill, drenched in sweat, huffing and puffing, and there's a lot of like cheerleaders, you know, like cheering on their friends and family, and then like whoever else goes by, they'll like, you know, give them some like positive energy.
Sure.
So walking, trying to keep my head up, but hey, I'm tired, huffing and puffing, covered in sweat. You know what this guy says to me? Look as strong.
Oh god. That's nice of him.
And honestly, I was just kind of laughing out loud. I was like, you know what? I've never been happier to be lied to in my life. Because I know that like there's a lot of adjectives I could use to describe me right there, but it would not have been looking strong.
Strong, yeah.
Like if I walked in the door right here, like looking like that, you would like, dude, you need to go to like ER right now.
That's funny.
Yeah, I look like I'm on the verge of death, and this guy's telling me I'm looking strong. I was like, that's
nice of him.
Yeah. So every now and then, it is nice to be lied to.
Yeah, for sure.
That was like the only like in-depth thought I had the whole time.
Yeah, no, that's funny. No, you know me, I'm all about that positive self-talk, man. I'll lie to myself all day. But yeah, no, that's funny.
Yeah, so what about you? What's new with you?
Well, shit, man, nothing as good as that, of course. You know, my life's not as exciting as yours. But yeah, just getting the notes together for the cancer and wanted to do this justice. So obviously cancer has affected both of us. Like, your dad had cancer. It's gone in remission.
Everything looks like it. Yes.
Okay. So it's gone. You know, my dad died of cancer. Not that long ago, honestly, maybe I don't know, 8 months ago, something like that. And so it affected us. Obviously, it affects a lot of other people out there. So when we initially started this ketogenic series and all the benefits of a low-carb diet, we knew we had to talk about cancer. That was obviously the big one. So that's why these notes are so damn long and why we're probably going to break it up into multiple podcasts, just because we want to, I don't know, like I said, do it justice. And so hopefully people can learn something and, I don't know, not be so scared of cancer. Cancer is such, like, it's like the big boogeyman out there. You know, people don't know about it. People just, you know, they don't want to talk about it.
Well, the current, like, understanding of it is that it's almost impossible to figure out. So, like, I mean, most doctors are just kind of confused. Like, hey, let's just poison people, radiate the hell out of them. And hopefully, like, their body's not damaged enough so they can come back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically what our current policy is.
Yeah.
Nuke the body, and hopefully enough good guys are back to repopulate the body.
Yeah, just cross your fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate that. So, and yeah, so let's just get into it. And it's going to be long, and just try and listen as best you can. And obviously, you can always reach out to us if you have any questions. You know, I'm always down to help. But so there are two theories out there when it comes to cancer. You have the gene theory and the metabolic theory. So Thomas Seyfried is pioneering the metabolic theory of cancer. And I pulled a lot of notes from the books and papers he's written. So he's really the inspiration for this entire podcast, damn near.
And before we go on, his background is in genetics. So if anybody would understand this, it would be him. Like, he was looking at cancer from a genetic perspective, and he's like, oh, there's nothing here. And then he, like, came across the metabolic theory, and he's like, oh, this makes way more sense. So, I mean, if he completely switched directions, like, what's everybody else's excuse?
Yes. No, that's a great point. And, yeah, like, am I biased when it comes to this? 100% I am. So, from here on out, you can take everything I say with a grain of salt if you want, but I always stand behind what I say on this podcast, and I try to give you the most accurate information based off my current understanding at that time. And obviously, this is podcast 81. If each podcast is like, I don't know, an hour, hour 20, we're talking over 100 hours of content. I've made a few mistakes throughout the time, and I've said some things that weren't right, and I've corrected them, but I still try to give you the most accurate information possible. But I firmly believe that the metabolic theory of cancer is right, and the proof is in the pudding. The gene theory of cancer states that mutations in various oncogenes leads to cancer. This theory is the current leading theory behind most cancer treatments and research into cures. So just look around. How are cancer rates lately? Is it going down? Is it getting better? No, not even close. It hasn't gotten better at all. Proponents of the gene theory will say it's complicated and we need more time and money to research a cure. But I call it BS. Your theory is wrong. You tried. It didn't work. It's time to move on.
We even got, like, AI systems looking through all the genes to find a pattern. They can't find anything. It's because there's no pattern there.
Yes. Like, it just seems like for whatever reason, they can't get that through their heads, you know?
And what's even crazier is the metabolic theory is older than, like, the evolutionary theory.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why, like, we've really made this switch to a theory that has never panned out and has never really shown any compelling evidence to make a switch, but it is what it is.
Yeah. So what's the difference between these two theories? It has to do with their perspective. Well, a lot of things, but what I'm going to focus on is it has to do with their perspective on mitochondrial dysfunction. It's widely accepted that cancer cells have dysfunctional mitochondria. The gene theory of cancer would argue that mitochondrial dysfunction is an effect rather than a cause of cancer, whereas the metabolic theory would argue the reverse, that mitochondrial dysfunction is the cause of cancer and the gene mutations that occur in cancer cells are just a downstream effect. And this may not seem like a big deal or a big difference, but confusion of the origin of cancer has stalled any progress on coming up with a cure. The discovery of DNA was a huge achievement for the human race. Honestly, it was like landing on the moon. Just it's like it's up there with the big discoveries we've done. But in the cancer world, it has set us back 100 years. President Nixon declared war on cancer. Nixon. Okay, that's 40. I don't, is Nixon still alive? I'm pretty sure Nixon's dead, right?
I'm not sure, but I would think so.
All right, old as shit. Okay, yeah. That's a long time ago, okay? The discovery of DNA put a huge emphasis on genetics and their role in every disease. Focusing on genes has led to the gene theory of cancer, and it has prevented us from making any real progress on developing a cure. And this is just my own kind of cynical outlook on things, But the gene theory of cancer has created a multi-billion dollar business for chemotherapy and other very profitable gene therapy drugs. It's big business now. And we all know once money gets involved, the truth matters less than profits. And something you mentioned is just the odds of once you get chemo, if you do bounce back from the cancer, your odds of getting something else increase, right?
Well, one of the side effects of chemotherapy and radiation therapy is cancer.
You're not making that up.
It's not funny. I mean, it's kind of funny. Like, that's what our treatment is one of the side effects is it's going to give you the disease that you're trying to treat. It makes absolutely no sense.
No sense. Yeah. But pretty much what that is like you're becoming a customer for life in this system. It's like a vicious cycle. And I don't know, man, it's just crazy. Like, the metabolic theory of cancer makes cancer way more manageable and makes a cure for cancer contain fewer and less complicated solutions, but aka less things to make money off of, which is obviously a problem for big business. There's no money in curing diseases. There's money in managing the symptoms. And that's obviously my kind of cynical outlook, but I think it's partly true for why this shit's still here. Because when you look at the facts, you're like, it's so obvious. How come this isn't, you know, taught?
Yeah, it's either that or they just have no faith that people can make lifestyle changes and that everybody's just looking for a magic pill. But there is no magic pill. There is no way to cure. We talked about all these different diseases. There is no one solution to it. Like, you have to change your diet. You have to change your lifestyle. But you have to do these other things. If you're relying on just some, like, one medical intervention, yeah, it might help you with the symptoms for a little bit, but it's going to come back. And that's just kind of, this is the same thing. Chemo and radiation, it helps for a little bit, but I mean, it's going to come back if you don't change your lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I hate about the whole genetic discovery is we blame everything on genetics. It's like, no, it's epigenetics. It's your lifestyle that's making these genes activate this certain way.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Oh God, you saying epigenetics wants me to talk about, we can't talk about everything. No. Yeah, we can't. I'll leave that alone, but yeah, you're not wrong. So let's start the conversation with the classic evolution argument. This is how I like to start most dietary conversations. And you obviously know that if you listen to the podcast. So if your supposed like super diet could only be possible the last 50 years, I don't want to hear about it. And I'm looking at you vegans. You know what I'm saying? Like, you couldn't do anything unless you had a few supplements. So it's obviously not the answer to the problem.
Supplements, refrigeration, transportation.
All that stuff. Yeah. Exactly. So hunter-gatherer societies didn't suffer from cancer at the rates we do now. People like the Inuit had very low cancer rates eating an animal-based diet. There's literally a paper written on the one time they found cancer in Eskimo. It was such a finding, it had to be written about. And it's titled, The Occurrence of Cancer in an Eskimo.
In an Eskimo. One. Singular.
I love that title for some reason. It's so funny. And I have that paper on the website, so yeah, I should have said this in the beginning, but all the papers I'm going to reference are obviously going to be on the website, like always. You know, I don't just make this stuff up, it's there, so you can read these papers, but so I'll have that paper on there. It's only like 2 pages, and it's hilarious, but they thought for a while it wasn't possible for the Eskimos to get cancer, because they never saw it in them, and they just, you know, obviously old white guys going to different parts of the country and poking people with sticks, you know what I'm saying? So that's what it was. But this is partly because they follow the Inuit, follow an ancestral diet that their bodies and genes are designed to eat. Cancer has only become a problem recently because we've changed our food environment so much in the last 100 years. We went from eating an animal-based diet of mainly protein and fat to a diet high in carbs and particularly grains. Our body simply hasn't had enough time to evolve to handle this new diet. So these crazy high cancer rates are really a product of our genes trying to catch up to this new way of eating. From an evolution standpoint, the last 10,000 years, which is how long we've been practicing agriculture, is a drop in the bucket. It's nothing. Our genes were never under any evolutionary pressure to change until very recently. It's going to take longer than 10,000 years for evolution to change our bodies in such a way that we can better deal with the damage caused by this new way of eating. And here's a quote outlining just how short of a period we've been eating a grain-heavy diet. Quote, in particular, the time since the Neolithic Revolution, which meant the transition from foraging and nomadism to agriculture and settlement, spans a fraction of less than 1% of human history. I'll repeat that, less than 1% of human history. Thus, the switch from a caveman's diet, consisting of fat, meat, and occasionally roots and berries and other sources of carbohydrates, to a nutrition dominated by easily digestible carbs, derived mainly from grains, would have occurred too recently to induce major adaptations in our genes, encoding the metabolic pathways. This is even more the case for the changes that occurred over the past 100 years, in particular the switch from labor in the field to a sedentary lifestyle and an increase in the consumption of easily digestible carbs with a high glycemic index, leading to diseases of civilization that are strongly associated with the Western, with the so-called Western way of life, end quote. And Western way of life, aka sitting on your ass all day and eating carbs, it's a recipe to get cancer. This is something that humans have been doing for a short period of time. It's not natural at all to start your day with cereal and then sit in your car for an hour and then sit in your cubicle for eight and then come home. That's not what our bodies are designed to do.
Yeah, and the big three foods is industrial seed oils like canola, soybean oil, that type of thing. Refined carbohydrates like flour, wheat, stuff like that. And then just sugar. Like those things were never a large part of our diet. And now we're told to eat that as the majority of our diet.
Exactly. And now less and less of us actually move our bodies at all.
Yeah. So like if we're getting all these carbs and we're not burning them off, like we're just completely changing what it is to be human.
Yes.
And yeah, there's going to be, if you completely change up the system, there's going to be some dysfunction going on. And that's what cancer is.
Yeah. So that's the gist of the evolution argument. Our diet and lifestyle has changed dramatically over the last 100 years, and it's leading to an increased odds of developing cancer. That's just what it is. So when it comes to cancer, there's a lot of complexities and nuance. I'm not going to say that going on a keto diet will ensure that you never get cancer. That wouldn't be true. There are other factors at play, obviously, but a keto diet can 100% give you better odds of not getting cancer and fighting it off if you do. Here's a quote talking about all the different ways we can get cancer. Quote, although very specific processes underlie malignant transformation, a large number of unspecific influences can initiate the disease, including radiation, chemicals, viruses, inflammation, etc. Indeed, it appears that prolonged exposure to almost any provocative agent in the environment can potentially cause cancer. End quote. I simply put, our bodies are exposed to so much toxic stuff, at least give our body a fighting chance with the ketogenic diet. And that's because one thing that is universally understood is that cancer cells love glucose. Even people who are anti-keto will have to admit that. They love sugar so much so that the scan we use to detect cancer, called a PET scan, uses a radio-labeled sugar analog to track where the sugar goes. Basically, we inject radioactive sugar into your body, and where the sugar goes is where the cancer is. The cancer cells just suck it up. There's really no debating that. Since that's the case, doesn't it make sense to limit the fuel that this disease loves? This is like an argument you would make. You make the very logical one-to-one arguments. Like, how can you even argue that?
I don't know. I mean, it's not taught in medical school, so that's why doctors don't make that. If, like, unless they learned about it in med school, it doesn't exist.
So frustrating.
I mean, it sounds so simple. Like, I mean,
honestly, the podcast could end there.
Yeah. It's like, okay, it loves sugar. You can tell that it's sucking up a ton of sugar. It's not normal.
Yeah.
It's using way more sugar than any other tissue. That's where the cancer is. So why is that going on? Let's just, if that's what it uses for fuel, take it away.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people I've talked to about cancer have had cancer, and their doctors tell them diet makes no difference. And it's so frustrating to me.
Oh, my dad went through that.
Yeah.
That was really frustrating. But it's just like, okay, so a fire, it needs oxygen. One way to put a fire out is to, like, cover up the fire. So, like, if you have, a blanket, a fire blanket, you just suffocate the fire.
And it goes out.
And it goes out. No more oxygen to the fire, fire goes away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can use that with tons of other examples. Like, your car. If I don't give my car fuel, it'll run out of gas and it no longer works.
It's useless.
Yes. Like, come on. It's simple. I could explain that to a three-year-old and they would understand that.
Yeah, but your oncologist will really fight you on that. It's like, God, man. And so this has been known for a long time. In the 1920s, it was shown that people with diabetes will all of a sudden stop peeing out sugar when they get cancer. If you didn't know, the hallmark trait of diabetes is really high blood sugar. And in response to this, diabetics pee out the excess sugar they create. But as soon as they develop cancer, those cancer cells happily take up all that sugar and they no longer pee it out. And it just shows how much cancer cells love sugar.
And so this is a correlational study, so obviously you can't make a clear causation from it, but there is a population that have abnormally high blood sugar levels. Those would be type 2 diabetics. So this study is in Sweden from 1998 through 2014 with over 450,000 type 2 diabetics. That's a large population. So it showed that the diabetics have an increased risk of many cancers, including a 231% increase for liver cancer, 119% for pancreatic cancer, and a 78% chance of developing uterine cancer over like the healthy population. So 231, that means you're 4.6 times more likely to develop liver cancer if you have diabetes. For 119, that's 2.4 times higher. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. Those are legit numbers. Like,
there are other cancers shown, and all of them have an increased risk. Mm-hmm. So it's not just like these three, like across the board, like you're at a higher risk.
Again, I know I said it in the diabetes podcast, but I wish our body had a system where high blood sugar was painful, because then people would understand the price they pay. When you walk around with a blood sugar of 150, you're paying a price.
Yeah, but unfortunately, by the time like you really start feeling the effects, like it's because there's been so much damage done.
So much. Yeah, you're right. So let's break down how and why cancer cells love glucose. We'll talk about something called the Warburg effect, and that's one of the hallmarks of cancer, meaning it's present in most, if not all, types of cancer. So we have two basic ways of producing ATP in our body. And ATP is just the energy our cell uses to do work. And don't any, like, biochemistry nerds out there, don't get on me. Okay, I know there's different ways to produce ATP, but we're just, you know, we're making it a little simple. Okay, folks? You'd be surprised the comments we get about this shit. We got some real nerds listening to this. But, so we have glycolysis and aerobic respiration. Glycolysis is the burning of glucose for fuel. It occurs in the cytoplasm of the cell and doesn't require oxygen. It's anaerobic. Aerobic respiration burns acetyl-CoA for fuel, and it occurs in the mitochondria and does require oxygen. Out of the two, aerobic respiration is way cleaner of a process and more efficient, producing more ATP and less harmful byproducts. And we talked about that in depth on the Cleaner Fuel podcast. So we compared burning glucose and burning fat. So if you want to learn more about that, just check that out. It's maybe like 5 or 6 podcasts back. But in a normal healthy cell, it'll always choose aerobic respiration if oxygen is present. Always. That's 100% the case. The only time a cell will briefly rely on glycolysis for ATP is when there isn't adequate amounts of oxygen available. Think of when you're working out and your muscles burn. At that point, the working muscle will rely on glycolysis, or more specifically, glycogenolysis, the breakdown of glycogen, which is just stored glucose in the muscle, for producing energy. But besides that, our cells always want to get their energy from aerobic respiration.
And at that point, you're still using both. It's just that your ATP demands are so high that it's using both systems.
Exactly, yeah, because you have like oxygen debt and there's just not enough oxygen around. Exactly. And however, in cancer cells, they choose to get their ATP from glycolysis even in the presence of oxygen. And that's the Warburg effect, and it's a hallmark trait of cancer. Here's a quote. Today, the Warburg effect is an established hallmark of cancer, i.e., a pathological capability common to most, if not all, cancer cells. End quote. They call this aerobic glycolysis because it's glycolysis in the presence of oxygen. And remember, normally that wouldn't happen. Healthy cells don't do this. Here's a quote. Aerobic glycolysis, or the Warburg effect, is also a robust metabolic hallmark of most tumors. Although no specific gene mutation or chromosomal abnormality is common to all cancers, nearly all cancers express aerobic glycolysis regardless of their tissue or cellular origin. End quote. So pretty much what that says is no matter the gene mutation, the cancer cells will uptake their glucose intake via the Warburg effect, further indicating that this disease is a metabolic in nature and not genomic. The Warburg effect is so powerful that it is required for cancers to grow. Here's a quote outlining that. Quote, nevertheless, it remained unclear whether the Warburg effect was a bystander in cancer pathogenesis until more recently, when genetic and pharmacological studies conclusively showed that the Warburg effect was required for tumor growth, end quote. So it is required for these cancer cells to grow that they uptake their intake of glucose. They need it. That's just how it is. Without this uptake in sugar intake, these cancer cells simply can't get enough energy to grow. Cancer cells are stubborn and hard to kill, but if you cut off their fuel source, they'll die, just like every other cell. Just like Tom said with the fire blanket, these fuckers will burn, but if you throw a fire blanket over them, they will die. Without the fuel, nothing's gonna live.
Everything needs energy, and if you cut off that energy source, what can it do? Nothing.
Diet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So reliance on glycolysis for energy seems like it would be a problem for cancer cells, because glycolysis only produces 2 ATP compared to 32 ATP from aerobic respiration. But cancer cells get around this limitation by taking advantage of the speed of glycolysis. So glycolysis can run at 10 to 100 times the rate of aerobic respiration. At that rate, cancer cells can match or even surpass the amount of ATP generated in a normal healthy cell. Also, cancer cells upregulate the expression of GLUT1 and GLUT3 on their cell surface, which are glucose transporters. They let glucose into the cell, ensuring that the cancer cell always has enough glucose around. These GLUT receptors work on the very low end of the glucose spectrum. So even if someone's blood sugar is great, and say like in the 70s, these receptors can still get enough glucose from the blood to keep the cancer cell alive.
All right, so let me just kind of break that down right there. So these cancer cells are able to keep up with the energy demands of the body by having more GLUT1 and GLUT3 transporters. That's the way that they're able to get more and more glucose into the body compared to a normal cell. Because a normal cell generally wouldn't need that much glucose. So it has to have more GLUT1 and GLUT3 transporters. That's what's going on there. And also, like, there's no reason why a healthy cell would want to use glycolysis primarily, because what you talked about earlier, 2 ATP to compare to 32 ATP. If you were buying a new car, you have two identical cars. One gets 32 miles per gallon, the other one gets 2 miles per gallon. Why would you buy the dysfunctional one that gets 2 miles per gallon? Nobody would do that. No. Everybody would get the 32 mile per gallon car. And that's what's going on here.
And the car that gets 2 miles per gallon is more expensive. If you think about the cost of the byproducts, it's a harmful. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like you would have to realize, oh, this car is definitely dysfunctional for it to only be getting 2 compared to 32.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens if we drop blood sugar, pretty much down to zero? Has that been studied? Yes, it has. And it successfully killed the cancer cells. Here's a quote. In 1962, let's say a Russian scientist, I'm not quite sure, or Polish maybe?
Korolzhou?
Say it.
Korolzhou?
Korolzhou? Okay. So I'm sure this man's dead too.
I don't think there's a question mark at the end of it, but...
no disrespect, old timer. But this gentleman reported... successfully treated the treatment of 2 patients with metastatic tumors by an insulin-induced hypoglycemic coma. Hyperglycemia, which is high blood sugar, on the other hand, is a predictor of poor survival in patients with various cancers and has been positively correlated to increased risk of developing cancer at several sites, including the pancreas, esophagus, liver, colon, rectum, stomach, and prostate in large cohort studies, end quote. And Tom obviously touched on that earlier with all these big studies relating high blood sugar to increased cancer rates.
Yeah, it's not a slight increase. It's a gigantic increase.
Gigantic increase, correct. Now, I'm not saying we need to put everyone with cancer in an insulin-induced coma, but it shows how important it is to keep blood sugars low if you want to kill cancer or reduce your chances of getting it. And maybe I should, I guess, clarify that a little bit more. So insulin brings blood sugar down. If you didn't know that, insulin is just a hormone our body produces itself. So... If you're just a healthy person, I shoot you with a bunch of insulin, your blood sugar will drop very low and you will pass out. And that's called like an insulin-induced coma. It happens, you know?
So what they did with this treatment is they lower these 2 people so low. I mean, they had to go into a coma. So this is very dangerous.
Yes.
Not going to be cost-effective.
This is in a hospital. This was medically supervised. You don't want to do this at home.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't like the recommended treatment.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just showing how powerful lowering blood sugar can be. So, like, yeah, they effectively, successfully treated 2 patients with this by putting them in a coma and lowering their blood sugar so low that they had no more fuel.
Yes.
That's just showing how cancer needs glucose. It needs it.
And these were metastatic tumors, meaning these tumors had spread throughout the body and were growing aggressively, which is, that's like end-stage cancer. It doesn't get worse than that. Most people don't come back from that.
I mean, I don't think going into a coma was, like, option 1. I'm pretty sure, like, they had no other, like, options.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Very true. So this is one of the reasons why simply going keto doesn't cure cancer. Keto will reduce blood sugar and decrease the amount of fuel cancer has access to, but it won't cut it off completely. And it may seem like, why do we even have the capacity for glycolysis if it's so inefficient and leads to cancer, or at least fuel cancer? Well, we all start out relying on glycolysis for fuel, and I mean literally all of us. As a fertilized egg implants itself on the uterus, it needs to generate its own energy long before blood flow and oxygen is directed to it. During this time, these very important initial cells all get their energy from glycolysis. These cells are rapidly dividing and are undifferentiated, and all get their energy from glucose. Sound like cancer much? That is cancer. That's a cancer cell. So this machinery and genetic memory of extracting energy from glucose and dividing like crazy is inside every single one of our cells. And that's a key point to think about. The state our cells are in a healthy body, isn't particularly natural. And this is kind of counterintuitive, but kind of follow along with me. Each one of our cells is really like a damn bacteria. It's selfish and wants to divide and eat on its own at the fastest rate possible. But our body has designed checks and balances to put these brakes, to put brakes on these greedy little cells and allow us to live long, healthy lives. It's when these checks and balances come undone that everything goes to shit. And here's a quote kind of outlining that. Quote, "The cellular default state is a condition under which cells are found when they are freed from any active control. Respiring cells in mature organ systems are quiescent largely because," that just means like they're cool, they're chill, "are largely because their replicative potential is under negative control through the action of tumor suppressive genes like P53. As P53 function is linked to cellular respiration, prolonged damage to respiration will gradually reduce P53 function, thus inactivating the negative control of P53 and of other tumor-suppressive genes on cellular proliferation," end quote. Basically saying, without these breaks, our cells go back to doing what they all want to do, which is eat and replicate like crazy. No different than like a teenage boy, really. That's our kind of our base state for all our cells. Well, you think that's a good time to first break, I guess?
Let's just kind of like unravel some of that stuff, just kind of break it down.
Sure.
So P53, that's a gene, and that's expressed to kind of regulate cells, right?
Yeah, keep them in check. Keep the whole system working healthy.
Stop them from just proliferating like crazy.
Yes.
I mean, pretty much every animal, every species wants to replicate.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything is driven to do that. And another normal,
down to the cellular level.
Normally you have some sort of predator or something out there in the environment to manage this.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if you have no predators to manage the population control?
Yeah. Population explodes.
Exactly. And that's what's going on with cancer cells.
Yeah.
There's nothing there to limit the growth. So that's what P53 does. And if it's not damaged or suppressed, then cancer is just going to spread like crazy. And that's what's going on there.
Exactly.
And something else that you mentioned, like it's natural, like every cell can do it. That's why cancer is in almost every tissue in our body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And every animal that I know of, every animal that they've tested tests positive for these oncogenes, these cancer causing genes. And that's because it's natural.
Yeah.
Like, everything is capable of having it. But the only animals that we see with cancer are either humans or ones that live closely with humans, and ones that we've impacted their diet and their lifestyle so much, that's completely unnatural.
Yeah, looking at you, dogs.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's like dogs.
Yeah, dogs.
Like, we always talk about, oh, we never see wolves with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see sharks with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hey, we got to study these sharks to see what the genetic thing is. It's like, no, yeah. They're living
it's their diet.
Yeah, they're living a natural, healthy lifestyle.
Yep.
I mean, maybe if we expose them to a ton of radioactive material,
yeah,
some radiation, then maybe they will.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, outside of those like extremely abnormal things, like they're not going to develop cancer.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's because they're living and eating a natural lifestyle.
Yeah, no, very true. Yeah, so I think that's a good place to stop part one of the podcast, just going over the evolution argument, why cancer cells love glucose, and why lowering glucose is a like should be option one on any cancer treatment. Next week, we'll talk about something called a retrograde response, and that gets, even the title is a little complicated, you know what I'm saying? So you can tell it's going to be a little complicated, so we want to give that its own episode. But yeah, hopefully you guys like that and learn something. Do you have a tip of the week?
Yeah, so last week I talked about ways to make your morning routine a little bit easier by starting the night before. So instead of getting into the physical parts of my morning routine, it's just like some body weight movements and some like yoga moves. Everybody should develop their own sort of like physical morning routine. I'm just going to get in the mental part of my morning routine. So after I turn off the alarm on my phone, I don't look at my phone again until I'm out the door. I don't want to get distracted. Basically, my morning routine is for me. And once I start looking at my phone, I'm start focusing on other people. And I can do that later in the day. So while I'm doing those like easy body weight movements and yoga moves, I do a couple things. So the first thing is my gratitude practice. I just think of either three people or three things that I'm just grateful for. So I'm grateful for somebody like Tyson. I've been friends with him for over 30 years. You can tell he's a smart guy. Him being smart and me talking to him all the time pushes me to be smarter myself. One other thing.
Ditto, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you. So like, I'm grateful that, hey, we're passionate about this. There's a lot of things that we could be passionate for. If we were passionate about basketball or something like that, oh, hey, yeah, that could bring us a lot of entertainment, but that's not really going to do that much good for us, you know?
Like, exactly.
If there's a, like, how do we pass that on to help other people? Mm-hmm. You can't really.
No.
Mm-hmm. You know, grateful for being this physically active and being in great shape. You know, especially running that last 50K.
Oh, for sure. And yeah. Smoking it.
Yeah. So the next thing I do after I do that is I do a daily goal every day. And I check, or do a weekly goal on Mondays. And at the beginning of the month, I do a monthly goal. So I check in. How did I do with my my daily goal yesterday? How am I doing with my weekly goal? How am I doing with my monthly goal? Just kind of just checking in with that. And then also setting new goals if it's the appropriate time. So doing that. I mean, that takes 5-10 minutes while I'm still doing my morning routine. And then the last thing I do from the mental side is while I'm brushing my teeth, while I'm looking in the mirror, I'm saying 3 things I like about myself. I mean, that's honestly, everybody needs positive self-talk.
I love that.
If you listen to any like professional athlete, all they do in their pregame warm-up is just positive self-talk.
I'm the best.
Yeah.
They can't stop me.
Kobe shot like, I think it's around like 27% in the clutch. I'm guaranteeing he thought he was going to make 100% of those shots. Like every like professional baseball player, if you average a failure rate of 70%, you're in the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
I mean, that's crazy, but you have to, every time you get up to bat, I'm going to hit this out of the park, Like, that's the kind of, like, positive self-talk you need to have, and that stuff just starts rubbing off.
It does.
Yeah, so, like, those are the 3 things I focus on, is just gratitude, setting goals, and then that positive self-talk.
Yeah. Oh, I love that, man. I've actually done that with people I know who are a little more, maybe insecure, you know, just down on themselves. I was like, man, you have to say positive things about yourself. You do. Because if you don't believe in yourself, guess what? No one else will either.
Oh, yeah, it's totally true.
It's totally true, yeah. All right, well, that's another podcast in the books. Hopefully you guys liked it. Tune in next week to continue our cancer talk. We'll break down a little bit more of the science behind it. Yeah, hope you guys liked it. You can find us at TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, so feel free to reach out anytime.
Yeah, please rate and subscribe on your favorite podcast provider, whether it's Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. There's a donate button if you want to show your support. It's a bright yellow button on the homepage. We'd greatly appreciate it. Hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.